Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hello, I'm John Bates. Livestock farming has its challenges, and sadly, disease management is one of them. The last few months have seen blue tongue turn up on these shores, initially in Kent, and cases subsequently have been reported elsewhere. The virus is known by the technical name BTV3 and is largely spread by midges. Cold weather is not very popular with the likes of midges, and so just now, and for a while at least we hope, the risk of spread is much reduced. Diseases are of course best managed with the use of science, and previous strains of blue tongue have been controlled with a vaccine. At present, there is no vaccine for the BTV3 strain. But will that change? And if so, when? Big questions, and here on the Food and Farming Podcast, I welcome three expert guests to share their knowledge of the situation and when and if science can do its thing. Dr. Carrie Button from the Purbyte Institute will be here, as will Dr. Mandy Neville from AHDB. But my first guest is Professor Andy Peters. Welcome, Andy. I know you're a vet, but tell us a little bit more, if you would, about what you do and who you are.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, John. Yes, as you rightly said, I'm a vet. I've been around for many years, actually, and spent my career doing a number of things in practice, in industry, also in academia. I've specialised in recent years in vaccine development, veterinary vaccine development, that is, and in regulatory issues. I profess to not being an expert at all in blue tongue, but hope to be able to give you some more generic information about the vaccine development process and regulatory issues.
Let's start off. If I put some sort of obvious questions to you, and please don't be offended if some of these seem a little bit silly, but I'm not a scientist, and in fact, I'm barely a podcast host. But let's just start with. So I'm right to think that it's a vaccine that's needed here, yeah?
My sense is yes, it is. Obviously, we're dealing with a virus here. We're dealing with an exotic virus as far as the UK is concerned. And there's obviously no known cure for that. It would be wise to have something which would help prevent infection and disease caused by that virus, and a vaccine is the obvious answer.
And what's the process to develop a vaccine?
Well, that is a very easy question to ask. The answer is a little bit more complex, but it's basically a linear series of activities, starting with identification of the cause of the problem. So in this case, identification of the virus, BTV3, that you've already mentioned. And since COVID, everyone has really become an expert on vaccines and understands at least a little about immunity and vaccination, and the principles there are actually pretty similar.
Okay, so just help me understand that if vaccines have been developed in the past to deal with blue tongue, why can't one of those be altered or adapted to cope with this strain?
Well, you pointed out in your introduction, John, that the available vaccines don't actually cross-protect against this particular strain, the BTV3. Previous incursions in this country were due to other strains, BTV8 in particular, I think. And unfortunately, those vaccines don't protect against 3. And so you have to actually start again by inserting that particular strain into the vaccine. Now, you can well add into what's already there to produce what's called a multivalent vaccine to protect against a number of strains at the same time. But you have to actually start by including that new virus.
When I was doing my research for this podcast, clever people were telling me that there are things called vaccine skeletons. Just can you tell us, what are they, and is there any prospect of one of those being available?
I'm sorry to say that it's not a particular term that I recognise. I understand what you're saying here, but it is basically using what already exists. So there are BTV vaccines. They are formulated, i.e. constructed in a particular way, and therefore you can actually add to them to add additional strains. So I think what you're saying is that previous vaccine that has been used can be regarded as that vaccine skeleton.
Okay, thank you for that. So what about if we move on to talking about activity and research that's currently going on, so that we can understand what's realistically on the horizon?
It's not entirely transparent what is happening in research terms. Carrie can obviously explain what is happening at Purbright, but my understanding is that there's been considerable activity in the Netherlands, where there has already been incursion of this virus. They have been working on this at the Lelystad Institute. And as far as I'm aware, they have developed what's known as a master seed for a new vaccine, and also a so-called challenge model, which is an important part of the vaccine development process. But perhaps Carrie can add to that answer, really.
Okay, so Carrie will be joining us in just a few moments. So just before we go to Carrie, I wonder if I could just ask you about the regulatory steps that need to be taken before a vaccine can be used. Are you able to share with us the kind of the hoops and everything that needs to be gone through before a vaccine could be available?
The regulatory process is quite complex, actually, but it's based on three very specific components, and they are known as quality, safety, and efficacy. And quality is probably the key part. It's all about identifying the actual main components of the vaccine and ensuring that they're pure and ensuring that the vaccine preparation process is consistent, particularly between batches, because vaccine preparation involves biological processes which are quite variable. And so one has to make sure that batch two looks very much like batch one, for example. So that's quality. So the second component is safety. And obviously it is important, very important, that one doesn't do any harm by using the vaccine, firstly to the animal, secondly, to anyone handling that product. Thirdly, to the consumer of the animal eventually. And fourthly, to the environment. Lastly, efficacy. Efficacy is about, does it actually do what it says on the tin? Does the vaccine, in this case, protect against that disease? And to what degree does it protect? So those are the main components. And actually, in establishing the evidence in all of those three is quite a long and complex process in the normal scheme of things.
Many of the people that are listening to this podcast will be farmers. And one question that is doubtless on their mind, that if a vaccine does become available, Andy, have you got any idea what that's likely to be costing a farmer to deploy the vaccine? Or a vet to deploy it on his behalf or her behalf?
Costing is a very difficult question as an outsider to answer, and is very much dependent on what's known in the industry as cost of goods. What does it actually cost to make a unit dose of that vaccine? And then obviously that is used as the prime determinant of the basic cost. And very often with a new product, you really don't know this until the job is complete.
Similarly, presumably you don't know whether it would be a single dose or a double dose.
What people don't often understand, although you can design characteristics into a a new vaccine. In effect, vaccine development, vaccine production is the art of the possible. So what you actually want at the beginning and what you end up with can be very different things. And so, yes, you want to design a vaccine that covers against all the diseases in one shot, but clearly that's very, very rarely possible. And so what you end up with is some kind of compromise.
You're listening to the Food and Farming podcast from AHDB. I'm John Bates, and I'm talking with experts dealing with the response to the blue tongue outbreak. They're here to tell us what's been done to combat blue tongue, which threatens our livestock, cattle and sheep and so on. I'm now joined by Dr. Carrie Batten from the Pirbright Institute. Thank you very much for joining us, Carrie. The Pirbright Institute, just for those that are not certain, it's a world leading centre of excellence in research and surveillance of viruses and diseases of farm animals. That's a fairly accurate thing to say, I hope, isn't it?
Yes, I think you're right there, John, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Just tell us a little bit about yourself, if you would.
Yes, of course. So I'm Dr. Carrie Batten, and I've worked here at the Pirbright Institute for nearly 18 years. Most of my career has been in and around Orbi viruses, which obviously blue tongue is the type species for. Pirbright hosts both the national and international reference laboratory for blue tongue, and we were really instrumental in identifying blue tongue type 3 in the UK and characterising the virus. We've spent pretty much the last 4 months working day and night to complete the large scale surveillance that has been undertaken by DEFRA and APHA in Norfolk and in Kent and the surrounding regions, and trying to support vaccination across the UK later this year should a vaccine become available.
Okay, so you were listening to the previous conversation that I was having with Andy, and again, I'll apologise for asking daft questions. Here's an obvious one. Why were we unprepared to deal with BTV3 strain?
Okay, so I think it's important to understand that there are 24 known blue tongue serotypes, which essentially equates to 24 diseases, and they have a very different global distribution. We have not seen blue tongue in continental Europe. And so its appearance in the Netherlands in September 2023 was a bit of a surprise to everyone. It was a surprise to the Netherlands, and it was a surprise to the neighbours of the Netherlands. We obviously here at Pirbright are working with DEFRA and APHA to monitor blue tongue across Europe and those blue tongue threats to us. So we certainly could see that blue tongue type 3 was causing problems in the Netherlands. And we were prepared in a sense of being able to deliver a laboratory response and a UK response to blue tongue type 3. But in terms of vaccination, that's a completely different ballgame. There are BTV vaccines, as we've already discussed. However, the previous BTV vaccines were against particularly BTV8, which we saw back in the UK in 2007, which caused a huge outbreak across Europe throughout 2006, 2007, 2008. BTV type 1 and BTV type 4. And these were inactivated vaccines, and they were very effective at controlling those serotypes. But at present, there is not a suitable BTV3 type vaccine.
Okay, so when I was doing my research that I referred to a few moments ago, I see that there are vaccines available in South Africa. Why can't we use one of those? Could a South African vaccine be modified, for example?
So I'm personally going to say absolutely not, and I will explain why. So the South African vaccines, firstly, were developed and produced for use in endemic countries, South Africa being an endemic country for blue tongue. These are live attenuated vaccines. So essentially, these are the viruses that have been made weaker, if you like, and are used primarily in endemic countries. They're also provided in a multivalent form, which means that you have more than one serotype in a vaccine. So in the case of the BTV3 component of the South African vaccine, that comes in a pot with an additional four serotypes. So essentially, you would be introducing those other four serotypes into the UK. The difficulty with live attenuated vaccines is they are able to spread in the field. There is the potential to revert to virulence. And there is also this phenomenon which happens in particular with segmented RNA viruses, where they are able to recombine, and that could result in a disease which is even worse than the one that we are already going to be dealing with. So they're not safe, and they're not licensed for use in the UK, and they're not safe or licensed for use in Europe. There are other vaccines in South Africa available for BTV3, and they have been assessed by the Dutch competent authorities as not safe or efficacious for use because they are not produced in GLP or GMP facilities, and the traceability of that vaccine manufacturing procedure is not present. And again, they are not serotype specific, they are multivalent and contain more than one serotype. So we can't really stress enough, they're not licensed and they're not safe for use in the UK.
Okay, thank you, Carrie. I think that's very clearly dealt with that. So more broadly then, who else is doing what?
So I think the sort of train of thought is that because there are procedures to produce these inactivated vaccines, and we've seen these being produced for BTV 8, 1 and 4, that there is a hope that pharmaceutical companies would be able to use this, and then there may be the ability, on the basis that the technologies have been used before, these vaccines have been shown to be efficacious and safe, that we might be able to push forward an inactivated BTV3 vaccine. But it's very much, you know, down to the pharmaceutical companies, the manufacturers, to take this technology on board and try to develop a vaccine.
And what about European colleagues? If they were able to develop and authorise a vaccine, would that be available for use here in the UK?
So I think we would look to our European counterparts and would try and push forward some kind of emergency authorisation for use within the UK. I personally believe there would be a level of due diligence for the UK to do before utilising that vaccine on our own shores, but we would certainly be looking to the data that has been generated through studies in Europe to support its use here.
I asked Andy about vaccine skeletons you know, whether one of those could be authorised. Can I put that question to you? What do you know about vaccine skeletons?
Yeah, so I think in this instance, we are dealing with a very different virus that at present won't have been utilised in that way for vaccine manufacturing. I think in reality, you would be looking to use the same technologies that were used to produce the BTV 8, 1 and 4 vaccines to produce a BTV3. And then there would be the option potentially to combine, for instance, BTV3 with BTV8 to produce a bivalent vaccine that protects against 3 and 8. Or you may want to put that into, if you want to call it a skeleton, with BTV1 and BTV4 or however you want to use it. But there is potential to sort of put two or more serotypes into a, say, the similar vaccine. But again, you would need to show that that vaccine gives a protective response to all three serotypes or the two serotypes that are present.
Lastly, for now, are you able to give us any indication as to how progress is going? How likely is it? And at what sort of time scale do you think a vaccine would be produced?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one. I think it really depends on the pharmaceutical company's appetite to produce a prototype and then to put it forward into trials. Certainly, the Dutch reference laboratory at Lelystad have a challenge model. Purbright also has a similar challenge model that would be able to be utilised. I think it really comes down to how quickly those studies to show quality, safety and efficacy that Andy has kindly already discussed, how quickly those studies could be done and how quickly a vaccine could be authorised.
Just like everything else, depends where you start from, really. But in this case, I would have thought it could be done in a year if you were given some kind of advantages in terms of the regulatory process. For example, it is possible to have in an emergency situation, what's known as a conditional or provisional license, where you don't always have to produce the full efficacy package, for example. And so that can shorten the development and regulatory period. And I would imagine in this particular case, sticking my neck out, that could be very well the kind of route that could be taken with BTV3. So, but it would still be a year at least, I would imagine.
Okay, and Andy, then just while I've got you then, let's just return to that question about what's going on.
The companies are clearly looking at it. There are those who have developed the BTV vaccines in the past to a European standard, and no doubt they're looking at it. But these things are commercially sensitive, they're confidential, and clearly they're competitive. So it's not always easy to find out exactly what is going on. Or indeed, if you do know, you're not able to divulge it. What I can say is that companies are very conservative in a way. They're not big risk takers, and they would be concerned about this particular disease. Yes, it's regarded as a major unmet need by the livestock producers, but the companies themselves have to invest a lot of money into producing these vaccines. And if the disease were to go away or be controlled, say, over one or two seasons, and then everybody forgets about it, and this has happened to a degree with these other serotypes that Carrie has been talking about, then their market has gone. And so it's a tough call for them to decide whether they really want to invest or not, unless there's some kind of guaranteed market. And of course, in this case, it is what we call purely a private good. It's down to the private sector to determine whether the companies produce a vaccine and whether the customers then buy it, the livestock producers then purchase it. So, and now if the government were to step in and say, yes, this is such a major threat to the UK industry, we need to guarantee the purchase of this vaccine or a part of it, then it becomes a different calculation. But it's just to say, it's not a slam dunk for the industry to say, oh, we've got this new strain of BTV, what a great opportunity, we'll produce a vaccine. As I say, they are not big risk takers in this situation.
Thank you for joining us on the Food and Farming Podcast. I'm John Bates, and my next guest is Dr. Mandy Neville. She joins us now. Mandy, you lead the Animal Health and Welfare team at AHDB. Just three questions for you. What's AHDB doing?
Thanks, John, and hello, everybody. AHDB was obviously aware of the situation in the Netherlands around blue tongue, and it wasn't necessarily a huge surprise that we saw some positive cases at the end of last year. We work in the background. We have networks of stakeholders. So we came together initially with those stakeholders to try and identify how we could best help our levy payers and you know, the farmers out there, particularly those in the control zone where the virus was first identified. We work through ruminant health and welfare, as you mentioned earlier, John. This is a stakeholder group. It has representatives from the veterinary organisations, from membership organisations, livestock auctioneers, APHA, governments, and so on. So it's a very wide network. And we came together, we set up a communications group, we set up a technical group. We've been trying to get information out to our farmers, to our levy payers, and trying to help them find their way through what they need to be doing. We set up a disease hotline so that farmers could phone up and get some guidance, either signposting to the relevant websites or information that they need so that they could try and minimise any impacts on their farms.
And is there anything in particular that you think farmers can be doing?
It's very difficult to prepare for a disease outbreak. but ensuring that farmers have a contingency plan on farms so that they've got things like phone numbers to hand. I think in terms of blue tongue, the message that we've really been promoting is that farmers need to remain vigilant to this disease, because if we can stop it early, if we can identify it when it first comes in, we've got a much better chance of controlling it and minimising risks to other farmers. So being aware of what the clinical signs might be on your farm, paying attention to your animals, you know, regular inspections.
And is that your message to levy payers then, to farmers, that sort of vigilance and surveillance and, you know, looking at your animals? And if they are looking at their animals, what are they looking for? Let's go for gold.
The clinical signs that you see in animals vary hugely. Some animals, as we've found, do not have any clinical signs at all. Dairy cows might have milk drop. Most severe signs are often seen in the sheep, unfortunately, and they are largely around respiratory signs, so discharges around the nose, the eyes, just being off colour, unable to eat, that sort of thing. There's a huge amount of information on both the government and the Ruminant Health and Welfare web pages about clinical signs with pictures. We've got some pictures, photos of clinical signs that they've seen in the Netherlands, and it's really worth having a look at those just to remind yourself what they are. I think one of the issues that we've got in the industry at the moment is that we are having problems with Schmallenberg virus, and we're seeing some lambs and calves that are deformed, and that's actually a clinical sign of blue tongue. So our message there is, don't just assume that it is Schmallenberg if you've got a deformed lamb or calf being born on your farm. There is free testing through APHA in England, and we are encouraging people to submit any animals, any neonatal animals that they suspect have Schmallenberg. Don't assume it is, and get it tested for blue tongue, because it is freely done.
So thanks to Dr. Carrie Button, Professor Andy Peters and Dr. Mandy Neville. Remember, there's lots of information that you can read on the government website. That's gov.uk/bluetongue. You can also type into your search engine ruminant health and welfare, and that'll bring up that website. There's plenty of information there if you're looking for it for more information. And of course, you can always look at the AHDB website, ahdb.org.uk. Stay safe, stay well. I'm John Bates. Thanks for listening.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.